and the woman came over with a coffee pot. Her eyes suddenly flickered, casting an anxious glance toward the doorway. Quickly, she turned and slipped into the kitchen. 4 Sekhmen entered quietly and lined the counter, leaning against it lazily. Phil seemed to be the leader of the quartet. He met Christy's gaze and grinned.
Got tired of breakfast in bed, little princess?
No, I got tired of seeing your ugly face first thing every morning. But as long as you're here, fetch us some bread and butter.
Phil's hand strayed to the butt of his gun.
You muty whore. I'll show you some fetching.
As Phil's fingers brushed the Tech 10, a black leaf-bladed throwing knife dropped into Jack's right hand. The flying blade pierced the back of Phil's hand, the razor point slicing through the palm and pinioning it to his upper thigh. His splayed fingers contorted like the fluttering wings of a butterfly transfixed by a pin. Before the 3 other Sekhmen could react, Christy, Jack, JB, and Doc were on their feet, overturning the table. They flipped it toward the counter, smashing it against the 4 men, making a wooden sandwich with a human Phil.
Son of a bitch!
One of the Sekhmen managed to draw his gun. Another knife appeared magically in Jack's fist. The Sekhman dropped his weapon, his jugular jetting blood. JB scooped the Tech 10 from the floor, but the sagging weight of the throat-slashed man, coupled with the force exerted by his 3 companions, flipped the table outward, bottom edge first. The wooden disc slammed squarely against JB's face. Still bent over, the armorer staggered sideways, glasses hanging askew, crimson gushing from his nostrils. A Sekhman flung the table away from him and closed on Christy. Christy ducked a roundhouse right and slashed savagely upward with the stiffened edge of her right hand. Her hand chopped into her attacker's throat like the stroke of an axe. Clutching at his throat for a moment, his eyes went wide and wild. Dark vermilion erupted from between his slack lips, and he fell, first to his knees, then to his face. Phil yanked the throwing knife from his hand and clawed for his gun. Fingers slick with blood, they couldn't gain an immediate purchase on the grip. As Phil fumbled, Doc held out his sword stick and assumed the classic posture of the fencer.
I told you I would remember what you called me, sir.
Fuck you, you old prick!
Phil's injured hand finally closed over the butt of his weapon. Doc lunged forward. The point of the rapier sank into, then quickly withdrew from, the left side of Phil's chest. A stream of blood followed it. In disbelief, Phil covered the wound with his left hand. Scarlet squirted from between his fingers. He raised the Tech 10 unsteadily with his right hand.
You old son of a bitch! You chilled me!
A little scratched. It will serve. King Lear, Act 4, Scene 2, I believe.
Phil pitched forward. Jack reached down and took the pistol from Phil's dead fingers. He aimed it toward the final Sekhman, who was breaking for the door in a panicked run. But before Jack could squeeze the trigger, JB fired from a half-crouched position. JB straightened, adjusting his spectacles. Blood ran unnoticed from his nose.
Ship of stoops.
And so are we if we stay here.
Christy took the Tech 10 from her unconscious assailant.
All we can do now is make a run for the compound.
Doc resheathed his sword, armed himself with one of the machine pistols, and moved toward the door.
Pity. I could still do with a cup of coffee.
The streets of Hellskell were no longer empty. People were converging on the eatery from all points of the compass. The companions held them at bay with the stolen gun barrels and threatening scowls. They trotted up the street, trying to cover all directions with their eyes, ears, and guns. The pace wasn't slow, but it should have been faster. Suddenly, there were over a dozen Sekhmen racing from the direction of the WAG compound. They fanned out in a circle, gun barrels bristling, eyes glinting with the desire to kill. Christy took it all in, surveying the weapons and the men behind them.
Time for a judgment call.
She dropped her pistol and placed her hands on top of her head. One by one, her companions did the same. Ryan and Mildred looked about them. The floor was surfaced with a highly polished light blue material, as were the smooth curving walls. Bending, Ryan rubbed his hand over the floor, then looked at his fingers.
Clean. You could eat off it. Looks like it's made of some kind of vanadium alloy. How do they keep it this way?
A low-level electrostatic field, probably. Right before Skydark, hospitals were experimenting with similar devices to keep operating rooms completely sterile. The field in here prevents dust and foreign particles from entering, pushing them toward the tunnel, like a giant whisk broom. That's the detritus we walked through when we came in.
Though they looked for them, there was no indication of spy eyes or security cameras. They moved carefully among the boxes, crates, vehicles, sculptures, and tables holding electronic parts and even more crates. There seemed to be an order in which the artifacts were stored, though none was cataloged by name or even number.
Kind of reminds me of crazy old Quinsford out in Alaska. Except this place seems even bigger, and the relics aren't touched by time. Maybe that electrostatic field you mentioned protects them.
As they wended a path through the artifacts, both noticed it was growing colder. The temperature seemed to have dropped by 10 degrees. Ryan finally put on his gloves, the ones with the index fingers snipped off to allow easy access to triggers.
Any ideas on how they keep it so cold in here?
Oh, must be a huge air conditioning system with giant circulating fans somewhere, like the blast freezers they used to have in food processing plants. Must be a terrific energy drain to pump air this frigid through the entire complex.
Probably have nuclear power, like most of the redoubts we've seen.
They passed several yellow four-wheeled contraptions, outfitted with long front-projecting prongs that Mildred identified as forklifts.
What happens to the people when we knock out the cold circulation system?
It depends.
On what?
If their metabolic rates have been artificially reduced through cybernetic alteration and organ transplants, just so they can survive in such low temperatures, the result of raising the temperature could be catastrophic. Depending on the age of their original soft tissues and organs, they could begin to decay almost immediately. That's what happens in cryonics when a subject is accidentally thawed out.
They continued walking through the vast space. Ryan gestured behind him to a long, massively built wag bearing a chrome-plated Winnebago logo.
There's got to be a big cargo Matrans gateway in here. There's no way a fleet of that many wags could have gotten up here any other way.
Unless they packed them up part by part and assembled them later.
What we really need is a map of the layout of this place. We could wander around in here for more than the 24 hours Hellstrom gave us.
Ryan grabbed Mildred by the arm. They crouched behind a table and watched a man, dressed similarly to Bob, sauntering between the aisle of artifacts. He was walking directly toward them. The man passed them without a glance. Ryan realized he was heading toward the chamber inside Lincoln's head. After a warning glance to Mildred, Ryan crawled among the tables, the wags, and the furniture. He couldn't allow Bob to be discovered. Dodging between the antiquities, Ryan managed to reach a point to the left and well ahead of the tunnel entrance. The man walked purposefully past. Ryan glided behind him, his left arm crooking around the man's throat. The man clawed at his attacker's arm. Ryan kicked his legs out from under him. A small cut was opened in the pale flesh. The man put a hand to it and stared as Ryan showed him the Sig Sauer. The man was middle-aged and slight of frame, with tiny eyes surrounded by puffy pouches of wrinkled skin.
Are you insane? Are you a fool? Get out of here!
Ryan pushed the man's hand away from the cut in his temple. It was superficial and bleeding only slightly, but the blood oozed sluggishly. The color wasn't a deep red, it was more of a dark pink with a crimson tinge. He wore a badge like Bob's, which identified him as Doug. Grabbing the man's tie, Ryan hauled him to his feet, put him in front of the gun, and marched him back to Mildred. The man gave her a look as though he were regarding a pile of excrement on a breakfast table.
You're from Hellskeller. Another undisciplined maniac, are you?
The remark irritated Mildred. She drew her ZKR and pressed the muzzle against his forehead.
Not exactly. In Hellscale, murder is indiscriminate and meaningless. I have a method. You don't talk, you die.
From my view, Strata, your methodology of data synthesizing is reactive rather than proactive. You've assumed a posture which is simplistic and adversarial rather than cooperative. Inasmuch as your rationale for trespassing on restricted property is based on an insufficient grasp of the legalities involved and the disposition thereof.
What the hell did he say?
Used to be called newspeak. Authentic corporate jargon. One of the few things I don't miss about the pre-dark days. In simple, unadorned language, I want you to tell us the layout of this place.
Ryan and Mildred aimed their weapons at more delicate portions of the man's anatomy.
There's a map on the wall.
They marched him ahead of their guns.
I guess not every one of Doug's organs is prosthetic.
Doug stood and looked at the map.
Complex display.
Suddenly,
A 3x3 foot square came alive with countless lines and